The KYMN Climate Show is a monthly feature here on 95.1 The One and AM 1080, discussing changes in climate and the science behind it. And now, your hosts, Alan Anderson and Bruce Moreland.
Welcome to the KYMN Climate Show with Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson, where we discuss climate issues in the news and then dig into some of those stories. Today, we've got a number of different stories about, guess what? Climate change.
Surprise, surprise. So, Alan, we're going to talk about climate change and Earth Day and a few other good things like that. Let's start off with what you've learned in the recent weeks.
So, a recent article in the scientific journals has been about the increasing temperatures in the oceans. And I think we think the oceans are so large that they are probably pretty constant. But in fact, scientists, by actual measurement, are estimating that oceans are absorbing 90% of all of the excess trapped heat. And as they track ocean temperatures, they see that the last 5 years have been the hottest 5 years in the ocean ever. The last 10, the hottest 10. And one of the alarming things is that the rate of increase in warming is going up significantly. And in fact, the rate increased from the rate of 1987 to 2019 is 4.5 times faster than from 55 to 86. So the heat content is higher than it's ever been in the last several thousand years, and it's increasing its rate of warming. So these things are pretty concerning. And one of the things that's interesting about measuring ocean heat content is that while air temperatures are actually quite variable, and we are able to get average annual global temperatures, but because of El Nino years and general disruptions of climate systems, they're somewhat variable, although the trend, unfortunately, is steadily up. But because oceans warm up much more slowly than the air, and they cool off much more slowly than the air, the temperatures in the ocean is actually a more accurate measure of the steady increase in global temperatures. And what we find in the oceans are a continued, uninterrupted, and accelerating warming of the rate of the planet Earth. And this is not good news. And 2019 was not only the warmest year, but it displayed the largest one-year increase in the temperatures of the oceans. Now, one might ask, how do the scientists know all this? Mm-hmm. And they have, there's a organization called Advances in Atmospheric Science, and they track, among other things, 3,800 free-drifting Argo floats, which measure all kinds of things out in the oceans, but they also measure temperature. And they also have something called their torpedo-like bathythermographs, which are like a miniature submarine hung below ships that are used regularly. And between these two key sources, they have a pretty good record of ocean temperatures going back to the 50s. So it's all pretty concerning. And as we know, as the oceans get warmer, hotter oceans melt sea ice faster, they help warm the atmosphere, and they cause more powerful storms when they form in the oceans. So it's pretty darned exciting.
It is exciting. So the ocean warms up more slowly than the atmosphere and cools off more slowly than the atmosphere. That's because water has a higher t- takes more energy to change water temperature, right? And anybody who's ever traveled to Duluth in July knows that that water up there is still pretty darn cold, even though the atmosphere feels plenty warm. In fact, it used to be that people would travel to Bayfield, Wisconsin, precisely because it was out on that little peninsula, and it was nice and cool. It was nature's air conditioning back before we had air conditioning units. So the lag, that would be called lag in a scientific or mathematical sense, between the temperature driving the ocean temperature, which is the atmosphere, and the temperature of the ocean itself, that's an important concept. That thing is like a buffer almost, if you will. That's interesting. Now, and the other thing you mentioned, and this goes to temperature, is that a warm ocean has a lot more energy in it, which is how you end up with stronger storms. And is that on top of El Nino, or is El Nino just kind of a background noise or a particular pocket of warm water that shows up periodically?
El Nino is typically a pocket of warm water, but it's a big pocket in the Pacific.
Pocket the size of half of the Pacific. Okay.
Right.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. So we're in the middle of what, week 6 to week 8 of the coronavirus slowdown,
yep,
as it were. It's probably the only story you're hearing on most media. So we thought we'd join the gang and talk about the coronavirus a little bit. And what I was curious about, and it occurred to me that, and we've had a discussion about this, getting ready for the show, we said, does the decrease in all the economic activity that we've gone through as part of shutting down for the coronavirus, and that, you know, although the rest of the world isn't shutting down necessarily as hard as we are, there are lots of parts of the world that have. I mean, we talked about Venice, the water runs clean there. All of a sudden, you can see the fish in the streams.
You can see the mountains in China.
Yeah, people are amazed that they, you know, I always thought that not being able to see the mountains in Seattle was related to atmospheric water, to cloud cover. But apparently, even that's improved right now. So people are seeing mountains they didn't know were there. Well, they'd forgotten were there, as it were.
Yeah.
So
anyway, just a quick sidebar there. Sure. The economic slowdown, when you think of factories that aren't running, and so they're not pumping stuff into the atmosphere, airplanes not flying, cars not driving, ships at sea, maybe sitting idle at anchor. So there's a lot less carbon emissions going on right now.
Exactly.
Across the world.
Exactly. A lot less carbon emissions. And the question is, could we see that in the data? And so I went and looked for data. And what I found was, I looked at the Mauna Loa data, what's known as the Keeling Curve data.
And for those of you who might not be familiar with that, that's the Mauna Loa is a mountain in Hawaii where they measure atmospheric CO2 concentrations.
That's right. They've been measuring it since the early 60s or mid-60s maybe. And it's really interesting to watch because when you look at that graph, you can see two things that really jump out at you. And the first is the Earth breathes. It just literally every year it goes through a cycle where the northern hemisphere is producing CO2 faster than the southern hemisphere is producing oxygen, and the two race against each other. And it has to do with it in the winter, the local winter, the plants and everything are not producing oxygen, and there's still, you know, there's carbon dioxide being produced by everything else. So it's very interesting to watch. So it's a sawtooth. And that sawtooth has been going up and up and up. And this is measuring just CO2 in the atmosphere. And when you look at the Keeling curve, you can look for evidence of things that might be going on in the background. So everybody likes to think, oh, Pinatubo, that must have created a huge effect. You know, volcanoes are responsible. And you're going to hear more about volcanoes in a minute. But when you look at the Keeling curve, you can imagine that you can see a slight decrease in something, but it's so small and it's so swamped by the oscillation and it's so swamped by the general trend up in CO2 that to blame anything on a volcano is absurd beyond words. And it turns out there was another volcano in 68 which was also invisible in the Keeling curve. So we'll hear more about that later if we get that far. In any case, it turns out that recessions like the 2008-2009 financial crisis and the 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union did not cause a discernible drop in CO2 emissions. And other factors that have tended to drive the curve up more steeply, like the economic rise of China, are also not visible as sudden events or changes in the curve. So it's overall the entire planet's activity that's causing this, and it's just not visible in short-term data. And one thing to remember is we feel like we've been in lockdown for months and months and months, and the early news reports come out of January, so our brain triggers that this crisis has been going on since January. Well, no. It's only been about, 6 to 8 weeks that we've been doing this hardcore? And so it's just a blip. It's just a blip. And it's fun. I'm going to put some data out on the website that you may want to look at, including a site at Scripps. You've all heard of Scripps, right?
Some may not have. Well, Scripps Institute.
Institute, yes.
It's and a highly prestigious scientific organization.
Very, very much so. And they have a graph there that you can see the Keeling data down to a day long. It's really funny to look at it because you see the data points on a one-day measurement.
Of CO2 at Mauna Loa.
At Mauna Loa, right. It's really cool. And then you can zoom it out and you can see it over a day. You started a day, you can see it over a couple of weeks and over a month and over. It's really fun. It's fun because it gives you an idea of how detailed the data really is behind this general curve. So anyway, turns out that we can't see anything in the data based on the fact that we've been slowed down for the 6 to 8 weeks. So I think that we'll see later that there is some interesting things going on, but the point that I need to make about this is that the Keeling information is data. It's not a model. And as I'm engaged in a conversation with somebody about the temperature seems to have leveled off briefly for like 18 years is the what's up is a completely uncredible not credible source, but they do have they get really excited about this 18-year gap, you know. And it turns out that one of the reasons they can get excited about it is they've rotated the data. Well, I can make any curve look like it's flattened out if you allow me to rotate the data. And that's an example of those are not models. Those are curve fits. And a model, if you're going to build a model, you need to have one that takes into account the amount of fossil fuels used in the year, the estimates of crop growth and seasonality information, the water temperatures and where it's flowing, whether you've got there's a really cool site, and I'm going to put it on the web, on our website, that is going to let you see somebody named Gavin Schmidt, and he's going to talk about skillful models, and he's going to talk about the emergent patterns of climate change as a example of what those models look like. And it's really interesting because these are what are called finite element analysis type models. So they break the atmosphere down into like 5 kilometer cubes, and they measure temperature and humidity and all these different variables. And then they turn the model loose and watch what emerges as development patterns. And it's really cool because his example, you can see hurricanes forming and getting stronger, and you can see all these things happening that we know happen in real life. And that's what a model does, is it looks for relationships not as curve fits, but in terms of energy transfer and, you know, the thermal properties, the wind properties, the rotation of the earth, all of that gets built into these models. And that's what a real model is. And then what you see with the data is just predictions, or it's measurements, depending whether it's something that comes out of the model or something that you're calibrating the model against. So it's like this. I might decide that I want to model how much weight I gain if I eat a lot of burgers, and that might be a fun model to test because I'd like to eat a lot of burgers, and I'd like to chase them with milkshakes, you know. And if Wayne Eddy was here with us, he'd say, and the quarterback club has the best milkshakes. And the best burgers. And so there you go. Anyway, I could have a model that said that for every 3,000 calories I consume and I burn 2,000 calories, that gives me a net of 1,000 calories a day. And I might say, well, that could translate to how much weight. And I could run the model and it would tell me how much weight I would gain. And then I could sit back and say, well, let's test that model. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to eat so many burgers and I'm going to eat and drink my milkshakes. And when I get done, I'm going to know whether my model is, and it'll turn out that I don't gain as much weight as I thought I would. Well, that means that something's wrong with my model. And I'll go back and I'll say, well, it turns out that writing a column or preparing a radio show is a mental exercise. And that takes more energy than I accounted for, because it turns out that our brain uses like a third of all the energy that we use or something like that. So, which suggests that if I go play chess, I can probably drink all the malts I want, right? Anyway, I'm kind of off the topic, but
if I can make a comment about models, one of my understandings was that the way that a climate scientist might then test his model after he's first developed it is to run it backwards across known data to see if with the inputs of known data, his model will create whatever they're testing, say global average temperatures, if his model will reproduce the temperatures that actually already occurred. And if he can get a good retrofit with his model, then he has some confidence that within the new inputs of how much carbon is being emitted and so forth, as he runs the model forward, it should give him at least a reasonably good estimate of what's going to happen in the future.
One hopes.
And in fact, there's been 17 major climate models related to temperature. And going back to as far as I think the 80s, and the majority of those models have been reasonably accurate. So are they perfectly accurate? No. But all of them predicted that we would have steadily rising temperatures if we had steadily rising CO2. And on that count, they were all correct.
All correct. What Alan has described is a form of back testing. You basically start the model in the past and you let it run forward through data that you already have and make sure that it does a good job of fitting that data, which is still, it's a model-based prediction. It's not a data curve fit. And if you look at I'll be talking a little bit about coronavirus again, and you'll see some more talk about modeling there. So anyway, so we haven't really seen a slowing of CO2 due to the shutdown yet, but we didn't really invent statistics so we could eyeball the data. So I'm expecting there to be some really good statistical analyses done once we get past this. So one more story on this is as Scooby-Doo used to say when he was in trouble, he'd say, "Rot-row," and we got a rot-row here because it turns out we may have flat beer. Flat beer, you say? Well, it turns out that beer and seltzer could go flat as the coronavirus shuts down CO2 production. Whoa! Now that is what we call in the business clickbait. It's a misleading headline designed to stir your fear and make you run out and buy more beer while it's still fizzy. And it's just an example of how the media like to take a fake idea and turn it into a headline, because then you can click through and they can make money. In some sense, our modern social media environment has turned our news media into carnival barkers, trying to get our attention, get us to throw the dime in the cup so we can go in and see the bearded lady or the whatever, you know. And that's how they make their money now. And yep, it's really, really not serving the people very well at all. So anyway.
Which is a good reminder of why it's important to get your climate information from climate scientists who are working for a scientific organization like NOAA, for example, as opposed to getting it from blogger websites.
Blogger websites like What's Up and CFACT. Yes, I pick on them all the time because it's so easy. Anyway, our next story, Alan, you're a major player in Earth Day here in Northfield. Tell us all about it.
Well,
or tell us the history first.
Yeah, I don't know that I was a major player, but I was on the committee for our local Earth Day event. And I don't know if any of you had a chance to chime in online, but we had a full day of activities and speakers all online with good social distancing. And I hope some of you benefited from those presentations. I wanted to give us a little background on Earth Day. You know, after World War II, in the 50s and 60s, we had almost no environmental regulation. And corporations and cities dumped their sewage and toxic chemical waste directly into rivers. And people who were burning and manufacturing things pumped toxic chemicals directly into the air. And I remember as a boy, we burned all of our trash in an outdoor trash burner. We had a 55-gallon barrel, and one of my jobs was to empty all the waste baskets in the house and then burn it.
See, Alan, you must have come from a rich family because we had to use a 30-gallon barrel.
Well, yeah, we did produce a lot of trash. There was seven of us. Anyway, it's hard to remember that as recently as the 60s, there was almost no environmental regulation. And rivers were bad. Air was bad. And in 1969, the Cuyahoga River that runs through Cleveland, Ohio, caught fire yet again for the 13th time. The river, as it was flowing through the city, was so filled with toxic and combustible chemicals that the river had burned 13 different times by 1969. And the 69 fire was particularly exciting because the fire was so large that it almost burned down two railroad bridges.
Oh, no.
Which caused the local fire department quite a bit of an excitement. Yeah. But it also got people's attention more so than it had in the past. In that same year, out in Santa Barbara, off the coast, there was a huge oil spill that killed tens and thousands of seabirds and marine life and porpoises and so forth. And these two events started the galvanization of a lot of different concerned citizens and environmental groups that started to work together to say, we really can't keep doing what we're doing. Things are getting worse and worse, and it's bad for Americans' health, not to mention bad for the environment. And so a grassroots effort was started to form Earth Day, and it was organized. The first one was April 22 in 1970. And in short order, so many Americans raised such a ruckus that in 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency was formed. The fairly weak Clean Air Act was significantly strengthened in 1970. The Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, and the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973. And all of these things happened under a Republican president with bipartisan support, with our Congress doing what was good for the American people based on science.
And you know, when you think about how that happened, it happened quickly. And I asked, you know, I have to ask, why didn't the industries that were being affected by these rules rise up and, you know, work against them and keep them from becoming regulations? And part of the answer is it was done quickly. It was done bipartisanly. And they weren't positioned for it yet. It was like they hadn't realized this kind of stuff might happen. Since then, entire industries have grown up around fighting regulations.
And undermining faith in science.
And faith in the government's ability to do things. Yeah. I mean, I can tell you that I'm going to... Can I go to my story about COVID again, or do you want...
Well, let me just bring us back to for a moment to the Clean Water Act. So the Clean Water Act prevented what we call point source pollution. That means that when the cities were dumping raw sewage into rivers, and some big factory was dumping their untreated effluent right into the river. Those point sources of solution were significantly cleaned up, and rivers that were almost lifeless, you could see into them, and there was new levels of fish and so forth. But it wasn't perfect. Bruce, you want to comment on non-point solutions?
I do want to comment on that, because it turns out that point sources are easy to find, but non-point sources are very hard. And there was a loophole in the Clean Water Act that you could drive an entire industry through. And so they did. And that loophole is one of the reasons that I point to that failing, if you will. I like to use the word failing. It failed to cover that issue. And if you go down to Iowa, they'll tell you that they are basically an experimental petri dish for what goes wrong if you don't figure out how to handle non-point sources. And it's one of the reasons that I believe that a carbon fee and dividend is the right first step toward climate change solutions, because it does address a non-point source. And it does so in a very clever way. And if you ever want to know more about it, we'll just have to have a little adult beverage, and I will explain it all by a campfire, a social distance campfire, of course. So anyway, that's an example of why regulations can fail, because they give powerful people a clean, easy target to get exceptions that keep them from being corrected and keep the market from correcting their behavior. So it's an interesting example in my mind. The other part that I want to make, though, is I want to have everybody kind of step back for a second and think about how the coverage has gone forward during the coronavirus pandemic issue. And you'll see that there are already activist groups pushing against the science and against the behavior of the government. And whether they're right or not is irrelevant. The point is they're motivated to be out there stirring the pot. And they make their money more from stirring the pot than they do from presenting solutions. And I know that there's some really interesting post work going to be done. There'll be more than one PhD that comes out of this analysis as to what the right approach to a pandemic is. So keep your eyes on that prize. All right. So, to recap, we talked about oceans getting warmer and why they are a significant heat sink, and how they've actually kept the air from getting warmer as fast as we thought it might initially. And that's an example where you look at the model and you look at the projections, and then you realize that you're not modeling something correct. So that fits in with our general discussion of modeling, too. We see that CO2 is still climbing, even though we've slowed the economies down quite a bit. And we learned a little bit about Earth Day. And that was kind of an interesting recap, because that was 50 years ago. It would have been a big deal this year if it hadn't been for certain, slowdown and social distancing.
Yes, this was the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
Incredible. And I love to point out that, yes, when you get bipartisan work in the Congress, you can get things done. And the president signed those bills, a Republican president. He went with the flow. Of course, now it might not be quite so easy.
Well, and as we mentioned, one of the big challenges for climate change, which, and this is something important to understand, climate change is a bigger threat to all of us and to all generations to come than all of the other environmental pollutions combined.
Yes.
Because it's an overriding atmospheric and oceanic climate change of the whole planet. And unlike a river, which you can clean up by stopping dumping into it, if we stop dumping CO2 into the atmosphere, the best it will get us is a leveling off at a new, warmer climate.
Right.
And so that's why it's so urgent that we level off as soon as we can.
We have a lot of farming in this area. Maybe sometime we'll spend some time on the show talking about how farming can really help with that. So, for links to today's stories and to the science, see the KYMN website and look under programs for the Climate Show. Also, feel free to send your questions to us at climateshow@kymnradio.net, and we'll get back with answers. Or we'll answer on the air.
And next month, on Wednesday, June 3rd at 11 a.m., we'll be discussing D-Day. D-Day? We're going to be discussing D-Day preparations as an example of national coordination and commitment to overcome a big challenge, and we'll relate this to the challenge of overcoming climate change.
Indeed. So, weather permitting and the creek don't rise, we'll be here next month with another edition of The Climate Show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the KYMN Climate Show, airing the first Wednesday of every month here on 95.1 FM and AM 1080. Your hosts have been Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. Copies of today's show are available for podcast at kymnradio.net.